Side 2, It, by Stephen King. Continuing on page 39. At the time of this writing, all three sentences are under appeal. Garten and Dubay may be seen on any given day girl-watching or playing penny pitch in Basie Park, not far from where Mellon's torn body was found floating against one of the pilings of the Main Street Bridge. Don Haggerty and Chris Unwin have left town. At the major trial, that of Garten and Dubay, no one mentioned a clown. Chapter 3. Six Phone Calls, 1985. 1. Stanley Uris takes a bath. Patricia Uris later told her mother she should have known something was wrong. She should have known it, she said, because Stanley never took baths in the early evening. He showered early each morning and sometimes soaked late at night, with a magazine in one hand and a cold beer in the other. But baths at 7 p.m. were not his style. And then there was the thing about the books. It should have delighted him. Instead, in some obscure way she did not understand, it seemed to have upset and depressed him. About 3 months before that terrible night, Stanley had discovered that a childhood friend of his had turned out to be a writer. Not a real writer, Patricia told her mother, but a novelist. The name on the books was William Denbrough, but Stanley had sometimes called him Stuttering Bill. He had worked his way through almost all of the man's books, had in fact been reading the last on the night of the bath, the night of May 28, 1985. Patty herself had picked up one of the earlier ones out of curiosity. She had put it down after just 3 chapters. It had not just been a novel, she told her mother later. It had been a horror book. She said it just that way, all one word, the way she would have said sex book. Patty was a sweet, kind woman, but not terribly articulate. She had wanted to tell her mother how much that book had frightened her and why it had upset her, but had not been able. It was full of monsters, she said, full of monsters chasing after little children. There were killings and, I don't know, bad feelings and hurt, stuff like that. It had, in fact, struck her as almost pornographic. That was the word which kept eluding her, probably because she had never in her life spoken it, although she knew what it meant. But Stan felt as if he'd rediscovered one of his childhood chums. He talked about writing to him, but I knew he wouldn't. I knew those stories made him feel bad, too, and then Patty Uris began to cry. That night, lacking roughly 6 months of being 28 years from the day in 1957 when George Denbrough had met Pennywise the Clown, Stanley and Patty had been sitting in the den of their home in a suburb of Atlanta. The TV was on. Patty was sitting in the love seat in front of it, dividing her attention between a pile of sewing and her favorite game show, Family Feud. She simply adored Richard Dawson and thought the watch chain he always wore was terribly sexy, although wild horses would not have drawn this admission out of her. She also liked the show because she almost always got the most popular answers. There were no right answers on Family Feud, exactly, only the most popular ones. She had once asked Stan why the questions that seemed so easy to her usually seemed so hard to the families on the show. "It's probably a lot tougher when you're up there under those lights," Stanley had replied, and it seemed to her that a shadow had drifted over his face. "Everything's a lot tougher when it's for real. That's when you choke, when it's for real." That was probably very true, she decided. Stanley had really fine insights into human nature sometimes. Much finer, she considered, than his old friend William Denbrough, who had gotten rich writing a bunch of horror books which appealed to people's baser natures. Not that the Urises were doing so badly themselves. The suburb where they lived was a fine one, and the home which they had purchased for $87,000 in 1979 would probably now sell quickly and painlessly for $165,000. Not that she wanted to sell, but such things were good to know. She sometimes drove back from the Fox Run Mall in her Volvo. Stanley drove a Mercedes diesel. Teasing him, she called it Sedanley, and saw her house, set tastefully back behind low yew hedges, and thought, "Who lives there?" "Why, I do. Mrs. Stanley Uris does." This was not an entirely happy thought. Mixed with it was a pride so fierce that it sometimes made her feel a bit ill. Once upon a time, you see, there had been a lonely 18-year-old girl named Patricia Blum who had been refused entry to the after-prom party that was held at the country club in the upstate town of Gloynton, New York. She had been refused admission, of course, because her last name rhymed with Plum. That was her, just a skinny little kike Plum. 1967, that had been, and such discrimination was against the law, of course. Hardy har har har. And besides, it was all over now. Except that for part of her, it was never going to be over. Part of her would always be walking back to the car with Michael Rosenblatt, listening to the crushed gravel under her pumps and his rented formal shoes, back to his father's car, which Michael had borrowed for the evening and which he had spent the afternoon waxing. Part of her would always be walking next to Michael in his rented white dinner jacket. How it had glimmered in the soft spring night. She had been in a pale green evening gown, which her mother declared made her look like a mermaid, and the idea of a kike mermaid was pretty funny. Hardy har har har. They had walked with their heads up, and she had not wept. Not then. But she had understood they weren't walking back. No, not really. What they had been doing was slinking back. Slinking rhymes with stinking. Both of them feeling more Jewish than they had ever felt in their lives. Feeling like pawnbrokers, feeling like cattle car riders, feeling oily, long-nosed, sallow-skinned, feeling like Maki's, Sheenies, kikes, wanting to feel angry and not being able to feel angry. The anger came only later, when it didn't matter. At that moment, she had only been able to feel ashamed, had only been able to ache. And then someone had laughed, a high, shrill, tittering laugh, like a fast run of notes on a piano, and in the car she had been able to weep. Oh, you bet. Here is the kike mermaid whose name rhymes with Plum just weeping away like crazy. Mike Rosenblatt had put a clumsy, comforting hand on the back of her neck, and she had twisted away from it, feeling ashamed, feeling dirty, feeling Jewish. The house set so tastefully back behind the yew hedges made that better, but not all better. The hurt and shame were still there, and not even being accepted in this quiet, sleekly, well-to-do neighborhood could quite make that endless walk with the sound of grating stones beneath their shoes stop happening. Not even being members of this country club, where the maitre d' always greeted them with the quietly respectful, "Good evening, Mr. and Mrs. Uris." She would come home, cradled in her 1984 Volvo, and she would look at her house sitting on its expanse of green lawn, and she would often, all too often, she supposed, think of that shrill titter. And she would hope that the girl who had tittered was living in a shitty tract house with a goy husband who beat her, that she had been pregnant 3 times and had miscarried each time, that her husband cheated on her with diseased women, that she had slipped discs and fallen arches and cysts on her dirty tittering tongue. She would hate herself for these thoughts, these uncharitable thoughts, and promise to do better. To stop drinking these bitter gall and wormwood cocktails. Months would go by when she did not think such thoughts. She would think, maybe all of that is finally past me. I'm not that girl of 18 anymore. I am a woman of 36. The girl who heard the endless click and grate of those driveway stones, the girl who twisted away from Mike Rosenblatt's hand when he tried to comfort her because it was a Jewish hand, was half a life ago. That silly little mermaid is dead. I can forget her now and just be myself. Okay, good, great. But then she would be somewhere, at the supermarket maybe, and she would hear sudden tittering laughter from the next aisle, and her back would prickle, her nipples would go hard and hurtful, her hands would tighten on the bar of the shopping cart or just on each other, and she would think, someone just told someone else that I'm Jewish, that I'm nothing but a big-nosed Maki kike, that Stanley's nothing but a big-nosed Maki kike. He's an accountant, sure. Jews are good with numbers. We let them into the country club. We had to, back in 1981 when that big-nosed Maki gynecologist won his suit. But we laugh at them. We laugh and laugh and laugh. Or she would simply hear the phantom click and grate of stones and think, mermaid, mermaid. Then the hate and shame would come flooding back like a migraine headache, and she would despair not only for herself, but for the whole human race. Werewolves. The book by Denbrough, the one she had tried to read and then put aside, was about werewolves. Werewolves shit. What did a man like that know about werewolves? Most of the time, however, she felt better than that. Felt she was better than that. She loved her man, she loved her house, and she was usually able to love her life and herself. Things were good. They had not always been that way, of course. Were things ever? When she accepted Stanley's engagement ring, her parents had been both angry and unhappy. She had met him at a sorority party. He had come over to her school from New York State University, where he was a scholarship student. They had been introduced by a mutual friend, and by the time the evening was over, she suspected that she loved him. By the midterm break, she was sure. When spring came around and Stanley offered her a small diamond ring with a daisy pushed through it, she had accepted it. In the end, in spite of their qualms, her parents had accepted it as well. There was little else they could do, although Stanley Uris would soon be sallying forth into a job market glutted with young accountants, and when he went into that jungle, he would do so with no family finances to backstop him, and with their only daughter as his hostage to fortune. But Patty was 22, a woman now, and would herself soon graduate with a B.A. "I'll be supporting that four-eyed son of a bitch for the rest of my life," Patty had heard her father say one night. Her mother and father had gone out for dinner, and her father had drunk a little too much. "Shh, she'll hear you," Ruth Blum said. Patty had lain awake that night until long after midnight, dry-eyed, alternately hot and cold, hating them both. She had spent the next 2 years trying to get rid of that hate. There was too much hate inside her already. Sometimes when she looked into the mirror, she could see the things it was doing to her face, the fine lines it was drawing there. That was a battle she won. Stanley had helped her. His own parents had been equally concerned about the marriage. They did not, of course, believe their Stanley was destined for a life of squalor and poverty, but they thought the kids were being hasty. Donald Uris and Andrea Bertoli had themselves married in their early 20s, but they seemed to have forgotten the fact. Only Stanley had seemed sure of himself, confident of the future, unconcerned with the pitfalls their parents saw strewn all about the kids. And in the end, it was his confidence rather than their fears which had been justified. In July of 1972, with the ink barely dry on her diploma, Patty had landed a job teaching shorthand and business English in Trainer, a small town 40 miles south of Atlanta. When she thought of how she had come by that job, it always struck her as a little, well, eerie. She had made a list of 40 possibles from the ads in the teachers' journals, then had written 40 letters over 5 nights, 8 each evening, requesting further information on the job and an application for each. 22 replies indicated that the positions had been filled. In other cases, a more detailed explanation of the skills needed made it clear she wasn't in the running. Applying would only be a waste of her time and theirs. She had finished with 12 possibles. Each looked as likely as any other. Stanley had come in while she was puzzling over them and wondering if she could possibly manage to fill out 12 teaching applications without going totally bonkers. He looked at the strew of papers on the table and then tapped the letter from the Trainer superintendent of schools, a letter which to her looked no more or less encouraging than any of the others. "There," he said. She looked up at him, startled by the simple certainty in his voice. "Do you know something about Georgia that I don't?" "Nope, only time I was ever there was at the movies." She looked at him, an eyebrow cocked. "Gone with the Wind, Vivian Leigh, Clark Gable." "I will think about it tomorrow, for tomorrow is another day." "Do I sound like I come from the South, Patty?" "Yes, South Bronx. If you don't know anything about Georgia and you've never been there, then why?" "Because it's right." "You can't know that, Stanley." "Sure I can," he said simply. "I do." Looking at him, she had seen he wasn't joking. He really meant it. She had felt a ripple of unease go up her back. "How do you know?" He had been smiling a little. Now the smile faltered, and for a moment he had seemed puzzled. His eyes had darkened, as if he looked inward, consulting some interior device which ticked and whirred correctly, but which, ultimately, he understood no more than the average man understands the workings of the watch on his wrist. "The turtle couldn't help us," he said suddenly. He said that quite clearly. She heard it. That inward look, that look of surprised musing, was still on his face, and it was starting to scare her. "Stanley? What are you talking about? Stanley. He jerked. She had been eating peaches as she went over the applications, and his hand struck the dish. It fell on the floor and broke. His eyes seemed to clear. Oh, shit, I'm sorry. It's all right, Stanley. What were you talking about? I forget, he said, but I think we ought to think Georgia, baby love. But trust me, he said. So she did. Her interview had gone smashingly. She had known she had the job when she got on the train back to New York. The head of the business department had taken an instant liking to Patty, and she to him. She had almost heard the click. The confirming letter had come a week later. The Trainer Consolidated School Department could offer her $9,200 and a probationary contract. You are going to starve, Herbert Blum said when his daughter told him she intended to take the job. And you will be hot while you starve. Fiddle-dee-dee, Scarlet, Stanley said when she told him what her father had said. She had been furious, near tears, but now she began to giggle, and Stanley swept her into his arms. Hot they had been. Starved they had not. They were married on August 19, 1972. Patty Urus had gone to her marriage bed a virgin. She had slipped naked between cool sheets at a resort hotel in the Poconos, her mood turbulent and stormy. Lightning flares of wanting and delicious lust, dark clouds of fright. When Stanley slid into bed beside her, ropey with muscle, his penis and exclamation point rising from gingery pubic hair, she had whispered, Don't hurt me, dear. I will never hurt you, he said as he took her in his arms, and it was a promise he had kept faithfully until May 28, 1985, the night of the bath. Her teaching had gone well. Stanley got a job driving a bakery truck for $100 a week. In November of that year, when the Trainer Flats Shopping Center opened, he got a job with the H&R Block office out there for $150. Their combined income was then $17,000 a year. This seemed a king's ransom to them in those days when gas sold for 35 cents a gallon and a loaf of white bread could be had for a nickel less than that. In March of 1973, with no fuss and no fanfare, Patty Urus had thrown away her birth control pills. In 1975, Stanley quit H&R Block and opened his own business. All four in-laws agreed that this was a foolhardy move. Not that Stanley should not have his own business. God forbid he should not have his own business. But it was too early, all of them agreed, and it put too much of the financial burden on Patty. At least until the pisher knocks her up. Herbert Blum told his brother morosely after a night of drinking in the kitchen, and then I'll be expected to carry them. The consensus of in-law opinion on the matter was that a man should not even think about going into business for himself until he had reached a more serene and mature age. 78, say. Again, Stanley seemed almost preternaturally confident. He was young, personable, bright, apt. He had made contacts working for Block. All of these things were givens. But he could not have known that Corridor Video, a pioneer in the nascent videotape business, was about to settle on a huge patch of farmed-out land less than 10 miles from the suburb to which the Urises had eventually moved in 1979. Nor could he have known that Corridor would be in the market for an independent marketing survey less than a year after its move to Trainer. Even if Stan had been privy to some of this information, he surely could not have believed that they would give the job to a young, bespectacled Jew who also happened to be a damn Yankee. A Jew with an easy grin, a hip-shot way of walking, a taste for bell-bottom jeans on his days off, and the last ghosts of his adolescent acne still on his face. Yet they had. They had. And it seemed that Stan had known it all along. His work for CV led to an offer of a full-time position with the company, starting salary $30,000 a year. And that really is only the start, Stanley told Patty in bed that night. They are going to grow like corn in August, my dear. If no one blows up the world in the next 10 years or so, they are going to be right up there on the big board along with Kodak and Sony and RCA. So what are you going to do? She asked, already knowing. I am going to tell them what a pleasure it was to do business with them, he said, and laughed, and drew her close, and kissed her. Moments later, he mounted her, and there were climaxes, 1, 2, and 3, like bright rockets going off in a night sky. But there was no baby. His work with Corridor Video had brought him into contact with some of Atlanta's richest and most powerful men, and they were both astonished to find that these men were mostly okay. In them they found a degree of acceptance and broad-minded kindliness that was almost unknown in the North. Patty remembered Stanley once writing home to his mother and father, "The best rich men in America live in Atlanta, Georgia. I am going to help make some of them richer, and they are going to make me richer. And no one is going to own me except my wife, Patricia. And since I already own her, I guess that is safe enough." By the time they moved from Trainer, Stanley was incorporated and employed 6 people. In 1983, their income had entered unknown territory. Territory of which Patty had heard only the dimmest rumors. This was the fabled land of 6 figures. And it had all happened with the casual ease of slipping into a pair of sneakers on Saturday morning. This sometimes frightened her. Once she had made an uneasy joke about deals with the devil. Stanley had laughed until he almost choked, but to her it hadn't seemed that funny, and she supposed it never would. The turtle couldn't help us. Sometimes, for no reason at all, she would wake up with this thought in her mind like the last fragment of an otherwise forgotten dream, and she would turn to Stanley, needing to touch him, needing to make sure he was still there. It was a good life. There was no wild drinking, no outside sex, no drugs, no boredom, no bitter arguments about what to do next. There was only a single cloud. It was her mother who first mentioned the presence of this cloud. That her mother would be the one to finally do so seemed, in retrospect, preordained. It finally came out as a question in one of Ruth Blum's letters. She wrote Patty once a week, and that particular letter had arrived in the early fall of 1979. It came forwarded from the old Trainer address, and Patty read it in a living room filled with cardboard liquor store cartons from which spilled their possessions, looking forlorn and uprooted and dispossessed. In most ways, it was the usual Ruth Blum letter from home. 4 closely written blue pages, each one headed, "Just a Note from Ruth." Her scrawl was nearly illegible, and Stanley had once complained that he could not read a single word his mother-in-law wrote. "Why would you want to?" Patty had responded. This one was full of Mom's usual brand of news. For Ruth Blum, recollection was a broad delta, spreading out from the moving point of the now in an ever-widening fan of interlocking relationships. Many of the people of whom her mother wrote were beginning to fade in Patty's memory like photographs in an old album, but to Ruth all of them remained fresh. Her concerns for their health and her curiosity about their various doings never seemed to wane, and her prognoses were unfailingly dire. Her father was still having too many stomach aches. He was sure it was just dyspepsia. The idea that he might have an ulcer, she wrote, would not cross his mind until he actually began coughing up blood, and probably not even then. "You know your father, dear. He works like a mule, and he also thinks like one sometimes. God should forgive me for saying so." Randy Harlingen had gotten her tubes tied. They took cysts as big as golf balls out of her ovaries. No malignancy, thank God. But 27 ovarian cysts. Could you die? It was the water in New York City. She was quite sure of that. The city air was dirty, too. But she was convinced it was the water that really got to you after a while. It built up deposits inside a person. She doubted if Patty knew how often she had thanked God that you kids were out in the country, where both air and water, but particularly the water, were healthier. To Ruth, all of the South, including Atlanta and Birmingham, was the country. Aunt Margaret was feuding with the power company again. Stella Flanagan had gotten married again. Some people never learned. Richie Huber had been fired again. And in the middle of this chatty, often catty, outpouring, in the middle of a paragraph, apropos of nothing which had gone before or which came after, Ruth Blum had casually asked the dreaded question, "So when are you and Stan going to make us grandparents? We're all ready to start spoiling him, or her, rotten. And in case you hadn't noticed, Patsy, we're not getting any younger." And then on to the Bruckner girl from down the block who had been sent home from school because she was wearing no bra and a blouse that you could see right through. Feeling low and homesick for their old place and Trainer, feeling unsure and more than a little afraid of what might be ahead, Patty had gone into what was to become their bedroom and had lain down upon the mattress. The box spring was still out in the garage, and the mattress, lying all by itself on the big carpetless floor, looked like an artifact cast up on a strange yellow beach. She put her head in her arms and lay there weeping for nearly 20 minutes. She supposed that cry had been coming anyway. Her mother's letter had just brought it on sooner, the way dust hurries the tickle in your nose into a sneeze. Stanley wanted kids. She wanted kids. They were as compatible on that subject as they were on their enjoyment of Woody Allen's films, their more or less regular attendance at synagogue, their political leanings, their dislike of marijuana, 100 other things, both great and small. There had been an extra room in the trainer house, which they had split evenly down the middle. On the left, he had a desk for working and a chair for reading. On the right, she had a sewing machine and a card table where she did jigsaw puzzles. There had been an agreement between them about that room so strong they rarely spoke of it. It was simply there, like their noses or the wedding rings on their left hands. Someday that room would belong to Andy or to Jenny. But where was that child? The sewing machine and the baskets of fabric and the card table and the desk and the lazy boy all kept their places, seeming each month to solidify their holds on their respective positions in the room and to further establish their legitimacy. So she thought, although she never could quite crystallize the thought, like the word pornographic, it was a concept that danced just beyond her ability to quantify. But she did remember one time when she got her period, sliding open the cupboard under the bathroom sink to get a sanitary napkin. She remembered looking at the box of Stay Free pads and thinking that the box looked almost smug, seemed almost to be saying, "Hello, Patty, we are your children. We are the only children you will ever have, and we are hungry. Nurse us. Nurse us on blood." In 1976, 3 years after she had thrown away the last cycle of Overol tablets, they saw a doctor named Harkavay in Atlanta. "We want to know if there is something wrong," Stanley said, "and we want to know if we can do anything about it if there is." They took the tests. They showed that Stanley's sperm was perky, that Patty's eggs were fertile, that all the channels that were supposed to be open were open. Harkavay, who wore no wedding ring and who had the open, pleasant, ruddy face of a college grad student just back from a midterm skiing vacation in Colorado, told them that maybe it was just nerves. He told them that such a problem was by no means uncommon. He told them that there seemed to be a psychological correlative in such cases that was in some ways similar to sexual impotency. The more you wanted to, the less you could. They would have to relax. They ought, if they could, to forget all about procreation when they had sex. Stan was grumpy on the way home. Patty asked him why. "I never do," he said. "Do what?" "Think of procreation during." She began to giggle, even though she was by then feeling a bit lonesome and frightened. And that night, lying in bed, long after she believed that Stanley must be asleep, he had frightened her by speaking out in the dark. His voice was flat, but nevertheless choked with tears. "It's me," he said. "It's my fault." She rolled toward him, groped for him, held him. "Don't be stupid," she said. But her heart was beating fast, much too fast. It wasn't just that he had startled her. It was as if he had looked into her mind and read a secret conviction she held there, but of which she had not known until this minute. With no rhyme, no reason, she felt, knew, that he was right. There was something wrong, and it wasn't her. It was him. Something in him. "Don't be such a klutz," she whispered fiercely against his shoulder. He was sweating lightly, and she became suddenly aware that he was afraid. The fear was coming off him in cold waves. Lying naked with him was suddenly like lying naked in front of an open refrigerator. "I'm not a klutz, and I'm not being stupid," he said in that same voice, which was simultaneously flat and choked with emotion. "And you know it. It's me. But I don't know why." "You can't know any such thing." Her voice was harsh, scolding. Her mother's voice when her mother was afraid. And even as she scolded him, a shudder ran through her body, twisting it like a whip. Stanley felt it, and his arms tightened around her. "Sometimes," he said, "sometimes I think I know why. Sometimes I have a dream, a bad dream, and I wake up and I think, I know now. I know what's wrong. Not just you not catching pregnant. Everything. Everything that's wrong with my life."
"Stanley, nothing's wrong with your life."
"I don't mean from inside," he said. "From inside is fine. I'm talking about outside. Something that should be over and isn't. I wake up from these dreams and think,
My whole pleasant life has been nothing but the eye of some storm I don't understand. I'm afraid. But then it just fades, the way dreams do.
She knew that he sometimes dreamed uneasily. On half a dozen occasions he had awakened her thrashing and moaning. Probably there had been other times when she had slept through his dark interludes. Whenever she reached for him, asked him, he said the same thing. I can't remember. Then he would reach for his cigarettes and smoke sitting up in bed, waiting for the residue of the dream to pass through his pores like bad sweat. No kids. On the night of May 28, 1985, the night of the bath, their assorted in-laws were still waiting to be grandparents. The extra room was still an extra room. The stay-free maxis and stay-free minis still occupied their accustomed places in the cupboard under the bathroom sink. The cardinal still paid its monthly visit. Her mother, who was much occupied with her own affairs but not entirely oblivious to her daughter's pain, had stopped asking in her letters and when Stanley and Patty made their twice-yearly trips back to New York. There were no more humorous remarks about whether or not they were taking their vitamin E. Stanley had also stopped mentioning babies, but sometimes, when she didn't know he was looking, she saw a shadow on his face. Some shadow, as if he were trying desperately to remember something. Other than that one cloud, their lives were pleasant enough until the phone rang during the middle of Family Feud on the night of May 28th. Patty had six of Stan's shirts, two of her blouses, her sewing kit, and her odd button box. Stan had the new William Denbro novel, not even out in paperback yet, in his hands. There was a snarling beast on the front of this book. On the back was a bald man wearing glasses. Stan was sitting nearer the phone. He picked it up and said, "Hello, Eurus residence." He listened, and a frown line delved between his eyebrows. "Who did you say?" Patty felt an instant of fright. Later, shame would cause her to lie and tell her parents that she had known something was wrong from the instant the telephone had rung. But in reality, there had only been that one instant, that one quick look up from her sewing. But maybe that was all right. Maybe they had both suspected that something was coming long before that phone call. Something that didn't fit with the nice house set tastefully back behind the low yew hedges. Something so much a given that it really didn't need much of an acknowledgement. That one sharp instant of fright, like the stab of a quickly withdrawn ice pick, was enough. "Is it Mom?" she mouthed at him in that instant, thinking that perhaps her father, 20 pounds overweight and prone to what he called the bellyache since his early 40s, had had a heart attack. Stan shook his head at her and then smiled a bit at something the voice on the phone was saying.
You... Well, I'll be goddamned. Mike, how did you..."
He fell silent again, listening. As his smile faded, she recognized, or thought she did, his analytic expression, the one which said someone was unfolding a problem or explaining a sudden change in an ongoing situation or telling him something strange and interesting. This last was probably the case, she gathered. A new client? An old friend? Perhaps. She turned her attention back to the TV, where a woman was flinging her arms around Richard Dawson and kissing him madly. She thought that Richard Dawson must get kissed even more than the Blarney Stone. She also thought she wouldn't mind kissing him herself. As she began searching for a black button to match the ones on Stanley's blue denim shirt, Patty was vaguely aware that the conversation was settling into a smoother groove. Stanley grunted occasionally, and once he asked, "Are you sure, Mike?" Finally, after a very long pause, he said, "All right, I understand. Yes, everything. I have the picture. What? No, I can't absolutely promise that, but I'll consider it carefully. You know that. Oh? He did? Well, you bet. Of course I do. Yes, sure. Thank you. Yes. Bye-bye." He hung up. Patty glanced at him and saw him staring blankly into space over the TV set. On her show, the audience was applauding the Ryan family, which had just scored 280 points, most of them by guessing that the audience survey would answer math in response to the question, "What class will people say Junior hates most in school?" The Ryans were jumping up and down and screaming joyfully. Stanley, however, was frowning. She would later tell her parents she thought Stanley's face had looked a little off color, and so she did. but she neglected to tell them she had dismissed it at the time as only a trick of the table lamp with its green glass shade.
Who was that, Stan?
Hmm?
He looked around at her. She thought the look on his face was one of gentle abstraction, perhaps mixed with minor annoyance. It was only later, replaying the scene in her mind again and again, that she began to believe it was the expression of a man who was methodically unplugging himself from reality, one cord at a time. The face of a man who was heading out of the blue and into the black.
Who was that on the phone?
No one, he said. No one, really. I think I'll take a bath.
He stood up.
What, at 7 o'clock?
He didn't answer, only left the room. She might have asked him if something was wrong, might even have gone after him and asked him if he was sick to his stomach. He was sexually uninhibited, but could be oddly prim about other things, and it wouldn't be at all unlike him to say he was going to take a bath when what he really had to do was whoops something which hadn't agreed with him. But now a new family. The Piscopos were being introduced, and Patty just knew Richard Dawson would find something funny to say about that name. And besides, she was having the devil's own time finding a black button, although she knew there were loads of them in the button box. They hid, of course. That was the only explanation. So she let him go and did not think of him again until the credit crawl, when she looked up and saw his empty chair. She had heard the water running into the tub upstairs and had heard it stop 5 or 10 minutes later. But now she realized she had never heard the fridge door open and close, and that meant he was up there without a can of beer. Someone had called him up and dropped a big fat problem in his lap, and had she offered him a single word of commiseration? No. Tried to draw him out a little about it? No. Even noticed that something was wrong? For the third time, no. All because of that stupid TV show. She couldn't even really blame the buttons. They were only an excuse. Okay, she'd take him up a can of Dixie and sit beside him on the edge of the tub, scrub his back, play geisha and wash his hair if he wanted her to, and find out just what the problem was, or who it was. She got a can of beer out of the fridge and went upstairs with it. The first real disquiet stirred in her when she saw that the bathroom door was shut. Not just partway closed, but shut tight. Stanley never closed the door when he was taking a bath. It was something of a joke between them. The closed door meant he was doing something his mother had taught him. The open door meant he would not be averse to doing something the teaching of which his mother had quite properly left to others. Patty tapped on the door with her nails, suddenly aware, too aware, of the reptilian clicking sound they made on the wood. And surely tapping on the bathroom door, knocking like a guest, was something she had never done before in her married life. Not here, not on any other door in the house. The disquiet suddenly grew strong in her, and she thought of Carson Lake, where she had gone swimming often as a girl. By the 1st of August, the lake was as warm as a tub, but then you'd hit a cold pocket that would shiver you with surprise and delight. One minute you were warm, the next moment it felt as if the temperature had plummeted 20 degrees below your hips. Minus the delight, that was how she felt now, as if she had just struck a cold pocket. Only this cold pocket was not below her hips, chilling her long teenager's legs in the black depths of Carson Lake. This one was around her heart. Stanley? Stan? This time she did more than tap with her nails. She rapped on the door. When there was still no answer, she hammered on it. Stanley? Her heart. Her heart wasn't in her chest anymore. It was beating in her throat, making it hard to breathe. Stanley! In the silence following her shout, and just the sound of herself shouting up here, less than 30 feet from the place where she laid her head down and went to sleep each night, frightened her even more. She heard a sound which brought panic up from the below stairs part of her mind like an unwelcome guest. Such a small sound, really. It was only the sound of dripping water. Plink, pause. Plink, pause. Plink, pause. Plink. She could see the drops forming on the snout of the faucet, growing heavy and fat there, growing pregnant there, and then falling off. Plink. Just that sound, no other. And she was suddenly terribly sure that it had been Stanley, not her father, who had been stricken with a heart attack tonight. With a moan, she gripped the cut glass doorknob and turned it. Yet still the door would not move. It was locked. And suddenly three nevers occurred to Patty Uris in rapid succession. Stanley never took a bath in the early evening. Stanley never closed the door unless he was using the toilet. And Stanley had never locked the door against her at all. Was it possible, she wondered crazily, to prepare for a heart attack? Patty ran her tongue over her lips. It produced a sound in her head like fine sandpaper sliding along a board, and called his name again. There was still no answer except the steady, deliberate drip of the faucet. She looked down and saw she still held the can of Dixie beer in one hand. She gazed at it stupidly, her heart running like a rabbit in her throat. She gazed at it as if she had never seen a can of beer in her whole life before this minute. And indeed it seemed she never had, or at least never one like this, because when she blinked her eyes it turned into a telephone handset, as black and as threatening as a snake.
"May I help you, ma'am? Do you have a problem?"
The snake spat at her. Patty slammed it down in its cradle and stepped away, rubbing the hand which had held it. She looked around and saw she was back in the TV room and understood that the panic which had come into the front of her mind like a prowler walking quietly up a flight of stairs had had its way with her. Now she could remember dropping the beer can outside the bathroom door and pelting headlong back down the stairs, thinking vaguely, "This is all a mistake of some kind and we'll laugh about it later." He filled up the tub and then remembered he didn't have cigarettes and went out to get them before he took his clothes off. Yes. Only he had already locked the bathroom door from the inside, and because it was too much of a bother to unlock it again, he had simply opened the window over the tub and gone down the side of the house like a fly crawling down a wall. Sure, of course, sure. Panic was rising in her mind again. It was like bitter black coffee threatening to overflow the rim of a cup. She closed her eyes and fought against it. She stood there, perfectly still, a pale statue with the pulse beating in its throat. Now she could remember running back down here, feet stuttering on the stair levels, running for the phone. Oh, yes, oh, sure. But who had she meant to call? Crazily, she thought, I would call the turtle, but the turtle couldn't help us. It didn't matter anyway. She had gotten as far as O, and she must have said something not quite standard because the operator had asked if she had a problem. She had one, all right, but how did you tell that faceless voice that Stanley had locked himself in the bathroom and didn't answer her, that the steady sound of the water dripping into the tub was killing her heart? Someone had to help her. Someone. She put the back of her hand into her mouth and deliberately bit down on it. She tried to think, tried to force herself to think. The spare keys in the kitchen cupboard. She got going, and one slippered foot kicked the bag of buttons resting beside her chair. Some of the buttons spilled out, glittering like glazed eyes in the lamplight. She saw at least half a dozen black ones. Mounted inside the door of the cupboard over the double basin sink was a large varnished board in the shape of a key. One of Stan's clients had made it in his workshop and given it to him two Christmases ago. The keyboard was studded with small hooks, and swinging on these were all the keys the house took, two duplicates of each to a hook. Beneath each hook was a strip of mystic tape, each strip lettered in Stan's small, neat printing. Garage, attic, downstairs bath, upstairs bath, front door, back door. Off to one side were ignition key dupes labeled MB and Volvo. Patty snatched the key marked upstairs bath, began to run for the stairs, and then made herself walk. Running made the panic want to come back, and the panic was too close to the surface as it was. Also, if she just walked, maybe nothing would be wrong. Or if there was something wrong, God could look down, see she was just walking, and think, "Oh, good, I pulled a hell of a boner, but I've got time to take it all back." Walking as sedately as a woman on her way to a ladies' book circle meeting, she went up the stairs and down to the closed bathroom door. "Stanley?" she called, trying the door again at the same time, suddenly more afraid than ever, not wanting to use the key because having to use the key was somehow too final. If God hadn't taken it back by the time she used the key, then he never would. The age of miracles, after all, was past. But the door was still locked. The deliberate plink, pause, of dripping water was her only answer. Her hand was shaking, and the key chattered all the way around the plate before finding its way into the keyhole and socking itself home. She turned it and heard the lock snap back. She fumbled for the cut glass knob. It tried to slide through her hand again, not because the door was locked this time, but because her palm was wet with sweat. She firmed her grip and made it turn.
She pushed the door open. Stanley? Stanley? She looked at the tub with its blue shower curtain bunched at the far end of the stainless steel rod and forgot how to finish her husband's name. She simply stared at the tub, her face as solemn as the face of a child on her first day at school. In a moment she would begin to scream, and Anita McKenzie next door would hear her, and it would be Anita McKenzie who would call the police, convinced that someone had broken into the Uris house and that people were being killed over there. But for now, this one moment, Patty Uris simply stood silent with her hands clasped in front of her against her dark cotton skirt, her face solemn, her eyes huge. And now the look of almost holy solemnity began to transform itself into something else. The huge eyes began to bulge. The mouth pulled back into a dreadful grin of horror. She wanted to scream and couldn't. The screams were too big to come out. The bathroom was lit by fluorescent tubes. It was very bright. There were no shadows. You could see everything, whether you wanted to or not. The water in the tub was bright pink. Stanley lay with his head propped against the rear of the tub. His head had rolled so far back on his neck that strands of his short black hair brushed the skin between his shoulder blades. If his staring eyes had been capable of seeing, she would have looked upside down to him. His mouth hung open like a sprung door. His expression was one of abysmal frozen horror. A package of Gillette Platinum Plus razor blades lay in the rim of the tub. He had slit his inner forearms open from wrist to the crook of the elbow, and then had crossed each of these cuts just below the bracelets of fortune, making a pair of bloody capital T's. The gashes glared red-purple in the harsh white light. She thought the exposed tendons and ligaments looked like cuts of cheap beef. A drop of water gathered at the lip of the shiny chromium faucet. It grew fat. Grew pregnant, you might say. It sparkled. It dropped. Plink. He had dipped his right forefinger in his own blood and had written a single word on the blue tiles above the tub, written it in two huge, staggering letters. A zigzagging, bloody finger mark fell away from the second letter of this word. His finger had made that mark, she saw, as his hand fell into the tub where it now floated. She thought Stanley must have made that mark, his final impression on the world, as he lost consciousness. It seemed to cry out at her. It. Another drop fell into the tub. Plink. That did it. Patty Uris at last found her voice, staring into her husband's dead and sparkling eyes. She began to scream. 2. Richard Tozier takes a powder. Rich felt like he was doing pretty good until the vomiting started. He had listened to everything Mike Hanlon told him, said all the right things, answered Mike's questions, even asked a few of his own. He was vaguely aware that he was doing one of his voices, not a strange and outrageous one, like those he sometimes did on the radio. Kinky Briefcase, Sexual Accountant, was his own personal favorite, at least for the time being, and positive listener response on Kinky was almost as high as for his listener's all-time favorite, Colonel Buford Kiss Drivel. But a warm, rich, confident voice. An I'm all right voice. It sounded great, but it was a lie. Just like all the other voices were lies. How much do you remember, Rich? Mike asked him. Very little, Rich said, and then paused. Enough, I suppose. Will you come? I'll come, Rich said, and hung up. He sat in his study for a moment, leaning back in the chair behind his desk, looking out at the Pacific Ocean. A couple of kids were down on the left, horsing around on their surfboards, not really riding them. There wasn't much surf to ride. The clock on the desk, an expensive LED quartz that had been a gift from a record company rep, said that it was 5:09 p.m. on May 28, 1985. It would, of course, be 3 hours later where Mike was calling from. Dark already. He felt a prickle of goose flesh at that, and he began to move, to do things. First, of course, he put on a record. Not hunting, just grabbing blindly among the thousands racked on the shelves. Rock and roll was almost as much a part of his life as the voices. And it was hard for him to do anything without music playing, and the louder the better. The record he grabbed turned out to be a Motown retrospective. Marvin Gaye, one of the newer members of what Rich sometimes called the All Dead Band, came on singing, "I Heard It Through the Grapevine." Ooh-hoo, I bet you're wondering how I knew.
Not bad, Rich said. He even smiled a little. This was bad, and it had admittedly knocked him for a loop, but he felt that he was going to be able to handle it. No sweat. He began getting ready to go back home, and at some point during the next hour it occurred to him that it was as if he had died and had yet been allowed to make all his own final business dispositions, not to mention his own funeral arrangements. And he felt as if he was doing pretty good. He tried the travel agent he used, thinking she would probably be on the freeway and headed home by now, but taking a shot on the off chance. For a wonder, he caught her in. He told her what he needed, and she asked him for 15 minutes. I owe you one, Carol, he said. They had progressed from Mr. Tozier and Ms. Feeney to Rich and Carol over the last 3 years. Pretty chummy, considering they had never met face to face. All right, pay off, she said. Can you do kinky briefcase for me? Without even pausing, if you had to pause to find your voice, there was usually no voice there to be found, Rich said, Kinky briefcase, sexual accountant here. I had a fellow come in the other day who wanted to know what the worst thing was about getting AIDS. His voice had dropped slightly. At the same time, its rhythm had speeded up and become jaunty. It was clearly an American voice, and yet it somehow conjured up images of a wealthy British colonial chappie who was as charming, in his muddled way, as he was addled. Rich hadn't the slightest idea who Kinky Briefcase really was, but he was sure he always wore white suits, red Esquire, and drank things which came in tall glasses and smelled like coconut-scented shampoo. I told him right away, trying to explain to your mother how you picked it up from a Haitian girl. Until next time, this is Kinky Briefcase, sexual accountant, saying, You need my card if you can't get hard. Carol Feeney screamed with laughter. That's perfect, perfect. My boyfriend says he doesn't believe you can just do those voices. He says it's got to be a voice filter gadget or something. Just talent, my dear, Rich said. Kinky briefcase was gone. W.C. Fields, top hat, red nose, golf bags, and all was here. I'm so stuffed with talent I have to plug up all my bodily orifices to keep it from just running out like, well, just running out. She went off into another screamy gale of laughter, and Rich closed his eyes. He could feel the beginnings of a headache. Be a dear and see what you can do, would you? He asked, still being W.C. Fields, and hung up on her laughter. Now he had to go back to being himself, and that was hard. It got harder to do that every year. It was easier to be brave when you were someone else. He was trying to pick out a pair of good loafers and had about decided to stick with sneakers when the phone rang again. It was Carol Feeney, back in record time. He felt an instant urge to fall into the Buford kiss-drivel voice and fought it off. She had been able to get him a first-class seat on the American Airlines red-eye non-stop from LAX to Boston. He would leave L.A. at 9.03 p.m. and arrive at Logan about 5 o'clock tomorrow morning. Delta would fly him out of Boston at 7.30 a.m. and into Bangor, Maine at 8.20. She had gotten him a full-sized sedan from Avis, and it was only 26 miles from the Avis counter at Bangor International Airport to the Derrytown line. Only 26 miles? Rich thought. Is that all, Carol? Well, maybe it is, in miles anyway. But you don't have the slightest idea how far it really is to Derry, and I don't either. But oh God, oh dear God, I am going to find out. I didn't try for a room because you didn't tell me how long you'd be there, she said. Do you? No, let me take care of that, Rich said. And then Buford Kissdribble took over. You've been a peach, my dear, a Georgia peach, a cause. He hung up gently on her. Always leave them laughing. And then dialed 207-555-1212 for State of Maine Directory Assistance. He wanted a number for the Derry Townhouse. God, there was a name from the past. He hadn't thought of the Derry Townhouse in, what, 10 years, 20, 25 years even? Crazy as it seemed, he guessed it had been at least 25 years, and if Mike hadn't called, he supposed he might never have thought of it again in his life. And yet there had been a time in his life when he had walked past that great red brick pile every day. And on more than one occasion he had run past it, with Henry Bowers and Belch Huggins and that other big boy, Victor somebody or other, in hot pursuit, all of them yelling little pleasantries like, We're gonna get you, fuckface! Gonna get you, you little smartass! Gonna get you, you four-eyed faggot! Had they ever gotten him? Before Rich could remember, an operator was asking him what city, please. In Derry, operator. Derry? God.
Even the word felt strange and forgotten in his mouth. Saying it was like kissing an antique. "Do you have a number for the Dairy Townhouse?" "One moment, sir." "No way. It'll be gone. Raised in an urban renewal program, changed into an Elks Hall or a Bowl-a-Drome or an electric Dreamscape video arcade. Or maybe burned down one night when the odds finally ran out on some drunk shoe salesman smoking in bed. All gone, Richie. Just like the glasses Henry Bowers always used to rag you about. What's that Springsteen song say? Glory days, gone in the wink of a young girl's eye. What young girl? Why, Bev, of course. Bev. Changed the townhouse might be, but gone it apparently was not, because a blank robotic voice now came on the line and said, "The number is 941-8282. Repeat, the number is..." But Rich had gotten it the first time. It was a pleasure to hang up on that droning voice. It was too easy to imagine some great globular directory assistance monster buried somewhere in the earth, sweating rivets and holding thousands of telephones and thousands of jointed chromium tentacles. The Ma Bell version of Spidey's nemesis, Dr. Octopus. Each year the world Rich lived in felt more and more like a huge electronic haunted house in which digital ghosts and frightened human beings lived in uneasy coexistence. Still standing. To paraphrase Paul Simon, still standing after all these years. He dialed the hotel he had last seen through the horn-rimmed spectacles of his childhood. Dialing that number, 1-207-941-8282, was fatally easy. He held the telephone to his ear, looking out his study's wide picture window. The surfers were gone. A couple was walking slowly up the beach, hand in hand, where they had been. The couple could have been a poster on the wall of the travel agency where Carol Feeney worked. That was how perfect they were. Except, that was, for the fact they were both wearing glasses.
"Gonna get you, fuckface. Gonna break your glasses."
Chris, his mind sent up abruptly. His last name was Chris. Victor Chris. Oh, Christ, that was nothing he wanted to know, not at this late date. But it didn't seem to matter in the slightest. Something was happening down there in the vaults, down there where Rich Tozier kept his own personal collection of golden oldies. Doors were opening. Only they're not records down there, are they? Down there you're not Rich Records Tozier, hotshot KLAD DJ and the man of a thousand voices, are you? And those things that are opening, they aren't exactly doors, are they? He tried to shake these thoughts off. Thing to remember is that I'm okay. I'm okay, you're okay. Rich Tozier's okay. Could use a cigarette is all. He had quit 4 years ago, but he could use one now, all right. They're not records, but dead bodies. You buried them deep, but now there's some kind of crazy earthquake going on, and the ground is spitting them up to the surface. You're not Rich Records Tozier down there. Down there, you're just Richie Four Eyes Tozier. And you're with your buddies, and you're so scared it feels like your balls are turning into Welch's grape jelly. Those aren't doors, and they're not opening. Those are crypts, Richie. They're cracking open, and the vampires you thought were dead are all flying out again. A cigarette, just one. Even a Carlton would do, for Christ's sweet sake.
Gonna get you, Four Eyes. Gonna make you eat that fucking book bag.
Townhouse, a male voice with a Yankee tang said. It had traveled all the way across New England, the Midwest, and under the casinos of Las Vegas to reach his ear. Rich asked the voice if he could reserve a suite of rooms at the townhouse beginning tomorrow. The voice told him he could, and then asked him for how long. "I can't say. I've got..." He paused briefly, minutely. What did he have, exactly? In his mind's eye, he saw a boy with a tartan book bag running from the tough guys. He saw a boy who wore glasses, a thin boy with a pale face that had somehow seemed to scream, "Hit me! Go on and hit me!" in some mysterious way to every passing bully. "Here's my lips. Mash them back against my teeth. Here's my nose. Bloody it for sure and break it if you can. Box an ear so it swells up like a cauliflower. Split an eyebrow. Here's my chin. Go for the knockout button. Here are my eyes, so blue and so magnified behind these hateful, hateful glasses, these horn-rimmed specks, one bow of which is held on with adhesive tape. Break the specks. Drive a shard of glass into one of these eyes and close it forever. What the hell?" He closed his eyes and said, "I've got business in Derry, you see. I don't know how long the transaction will take. How about 3 days with an option to renew?"
An option to renew?
The desk clerk asked doubtfully. And Rich waited patiently for the fellow to work it over in his mind.
Oh, I get you. That's very good.
Thank you, and I, hope you can vote for us in November, John F. Kennedy said. Jackie wants to, do over the, Oval Office, and I've got a job all lined up for my, brother Bobby.
Mr. Tozier?
Yes?
Okay, somebody else got on the line there for a few seconds.
Just an old pal from the DOP, Rich thought. That's dead old party, in case you should wonder. Don't worry about it. A shudder worked through him, and he told himself again, almost desperately, You're okay, Rich. I heard it too, Rich said. Must have been a line crossover. How are we looking on that room?
Oh, there's no problem with that, the clerk said. We do business here in Derry, but it really never booms.
Is that so?
Oh, yeah,
the clerk agreed, and Rich shuddered again. He had forgotten that, too, that simple northern New Englandism for yes.
Oh, yeah.
Gonna get you, creep.
The ghostly voice of Henry Bowers screamed, and he felt more crypts cracking open inside of him. The stench he smelled was not decayed bodies, but decayed memories. And that was somehow worse. He gave the townhouse clerk his American Express number and hung up. Then he called Steve Koval, the KLAD program director.
What's up, Rich? Steve asked.
The last Arbitron ratings had shown KLAD at the top of the cannibalistic Los Angeles FM rock market, and ever since then Steve had been in an excellent mood. Thank God for small favors.
Well, you might be sorry you asked, he told Steve. I'm taking a powder.
Taking? He could hear the frown in Steve's voice.
I don't think I get you, Rich.
I have to put on my boogie shoes. I'm going away.
What do you mean, going away?
According to the log I have right here in front of me, you're on the air tomorrow from 2 in the afternoon until 6 p.m., just like always. In fact, you're interviewing Clarence Clemens in the studio at 4. You know Clarence Clemens, Rich? As in, come on and blow, big man?
Clemens can talk to Mike O'Hara as well as he can talk to me.
Clarence doesn't want to talk to Mike, Rich. Clarence doesn't want to talk to Bobby Russell. He doesn't want to talk to me.
Clarence is a big fan of Buford Kiss Drivel and Wyatt the Homicidal Bag Boy. He wants to talk to you, my friend, and I have no interest in having a pissed-off 250-pound saxophone player who was once almost drafted by a pro football team running amok in my studio.
I don't think he has a history of running amok, Rich said. I mean, we're talking Clarence Clemens here, not Keith Moon. There was silence on the line. Rich waited patiently.
You're not serious, are you?
Steve finally asked. He sounded plaintive.
I mean, unless your mother just died or you've got to have a brain tumor out or something, this is called crapping out.
I have to go, Steve.
Is your mother sick? Did she, God forbid, die?
She died 10 years ago.
Have you got a brain tumor?
Not even a rectal polyp.
This is not funny, Rich.
No.
You're being a fucking busher, and I don't like it.
I don't like it either, but I have to go.
Where? Why? What is this? Talk to me, Rich.
Someone called me. Someone I used to know a long time ago, in another place. Back then, something happened. I made a promise. We all promised that we would go back if the something started happening again. And I guess it has.
What something are we talking about, Rich?
I'd just as soon not say.
Also, you'll think I'm crazy if I tell you the truth.
I don't remember.
When did you make this famous promise?
A long time ago, in the summer of 1958. There was another long pause, and he knew Steve Koval was trying to decide if Rich Records Tozier, a.k.a. Buford Kiss Drivel, a.k.a. Wyatt the Homicidal Bag Boy, etc., etc., was having him on or was having some kind of mental breakdown.
You would have been just a kid, Steve said flatly.
11, going on 12. Another long pause. Rich waited patiently.
All right, Steve said. I'll shift the rotation. Put Mike in for you. I can call Chuck Foster to pull a few shifts, I guess, if I can find what Chinese restaurant he's currently holed up in. I'll do it because we go back a long way together. But I'm never going to forget you bushed out on me, Rich.
Oh, get down off it, Rich said. But the headache was getting worse. He knew what he was doing. Did Steve really think he didn't?
I need a few days off is all. You're acting like I took a shit on our FCC charter. A few days off for what? The reunion of your Cub Scout pack in Shithouse Falls, North Dakota, or Pussy Hump City, West Virginia?
Actually, I think Shithouse Falls in Arkansas, Bo, Buford Kissdribble said in his big hollow barrel voice. But Steve was not to be diverted. Because you made a promise when you were 11? Kids don't make serious promises when they're 11, for Christ's sake. And it's not even that, Rich, and you know it. This is not an insurance company. This is not a law office. This is show business, be it ever so humble, and you fucking well know it. If you had given me a week's notice, I wouldn't be holding this phone in one hand and a bottle of my Lanta in the other. You are putting my balls to the wall, and you know it. So don't you insult my intelligence. Steve was nearly screaming now, and Rich closed his eyes. I'm never going to forget it, Steve had said, and Rich supposed he never would. But Steve had also said kids didn't make serious promises when they were 11, and that wasn't true at all. Rich couldn't remember what the promise had been, wasn't sure he wanted to remember, but it had been plenty serious. Steve, I have to. Yeah, and I told you I could handle it, so go ahead. Go ahead, you busher. Steve, this is But Steve had already hung up. Rich put the phone down. He had barely started away from it when it began to ring again, and he knew without picking it up that it was Steve again, madder than ever. Talking to him at this point would do no good. Things would just get uglier. He slid the switch on the side of the phone to the right, cutting it off in mid-ring. He went upstairs, pulled two suitcases out of the closet, and filled them with the barely glanced-at conglomeration of clothes. Jeans, shirts, underwear, socks. It would not occur to him until later that he had taken nothing but kid clothes. He carried the suitcases back downstairs. On the den wall was a black-and-white Ansel Adams photograph of Big Sur. Rich swung it back on hidden hinges, exposing a barrel safe. He opened it, pawed his way past the paperwork, the house here poised cozily between the fault line and the brush fire zone, 20 acres of timberland in Idaho, a bunch of stocks. He had bought the stock seemingly at random. When his brokers saw Rich coming, he immediately clutched his head. But the stocks had all risen steadily over the years. He was sometimes surprised by the thought that he was almost, not quite, but almost, a rich man. All courtesy of rock and roll music. And the voices, of course. House, acres, stocks, insurance policy, even a copy of his last will and testament. The strings that bind you tight to the map of your life, he thought. There was a sudden wild impulse to whip out his Zippo and light it up. The whole whore's combine of wherefores and know ye all men by these presents, and the bearer of this certificate is entitled. And he could do it, too. The papers in his safe had suddenly ceased to signify anything. The first real terror struck him then, and there was nothing at all supernatural about it. It was only a realization of how easy it was to trash your life. That was what was so scary. You just drag the fan up to everything you had spent the years raking together and turn the motherfucker on. Easy. Burn it up or blow it away, then just take a powder. Behind the papers, which were only currency's second cousins, was the real stuff, the cash. $4,000 in tens, twenties, and fifties. Taking it now, stuffing it into the pocket of his jeans, he wondered if he hadn't somehow known what he was doing when he put the money in here. $50 one month, $120 the next, maybe only $10 the month after that. Rat hole money. Taking a powder money. Man, that's scary, he said, barely aware he had spoken. He was looking blankly out the big window at the beach. It was deserted now, the surfers gone, the honeymooners, if that was what they had been, gone too. Ah, yes, Doc. It all comes back to me now. Remember Stanley Uris, for instance? Bet your fur I do. Remember how we used to say that and think it was so cool? Stanley Urin, the big kids called him. Hey, Urin. Hey, you fucking Christ killer. Where you going? One of your fag friends gonna give you a BJ? He slammed the safe door shut and swung the picture back into place. When had he last thought of Stan Uris? 5 years ago? 10? 20? Rich and his family had moved away from Derry in the spring of 1960. And how fast all of their faces faded. His gang, that pitiful bunch of losers with their little clubhouse in what had been known then as the Barrens. Funny name for an area as lush with growth as that place had been. Kidding themselves that they were jungle explorers or seabees carving out a landing strip on a Pacific atoll while they held off the Japs. Kidding themselves that they were dam builders, cowboys, spacemen on a jungle world. You name it. But whatever you name it, don't let's forget what it really was. It was hiding. Hiding from the big kids.
hiding from Henry Bowers and Victor Chris and Belch Huggins and the rest of them. What a bunch of losers they had been. Stan Uris with his big Jew boy nose. Bill Denbro, who could say nothing but "Hi-yo, Silver" without stuttering so badly that it drove you almost dog shit. Beverly Marsh, with her bruises and her cigarettes rolled into the sleeve of her blouse. Ben Hanscom, who had been so big he looked like a human version of Moby Dick. And Richie Tozier, with his thick glasses and his A-averages and his wise mouth and his face, which just begged to be pounded into new and exciting shapes. Was there a word for what they had been? Oh, yes, there always was.
Le mot juste. In this case, le mot juste was wimps.
How it came back. How it all came back. And now he stood here in his den shivering as helplessly as a homeless mutt caught in a thunderstorm. Shivering because the guys he had run with weren't all he remembered. There were other things. Things he hadn't thought of in years, trembling just below the surface. Bloody things. A darkness. Some darkness. The house on Niebolt Street and Bill screaming, "You could kill my brother, you f-f-fucker!" Did he remember? Just enough not to want to remember anymore. And you could bet your fur on that. A smell of garbage, a smell of shit, and a smell of something else. Something worse than either. It was the stink of the beast, the stink of it. Down there in the darkness under Derry where the machines thundered on and on. He remembered George. But that was too much, and he ran for the bathroom, blundering into his Eames chair on his way and almost falling. He made it, barely. He slid across the slick tiles to the toilet on his knees like some weird breakdancer, gripped the edges, and vomited everything in his guts. Even then, it wouldn't stop. Suddenly, he could see Georgie Denbro as if he had last seen him yesterday. Georgie, who had been the start of it all. Georgie, who had been murdered in the fall of 1957. Georgie had died right after the flood. One of his arms had been ripped from its socket, and Rich had blocked all of that out of his memory. But sometimes those things come back. Oh, yes, indeedy, they come back. Sometimes they come back. The spasm passed, and Rich groped blindly for the flush. Water roared. His early supper, regurgitated in hot chunks, vanished tastefully down the drain, into the sewers, into the pound and stink and darkness of the sewers. He closed the lid, laid his forehead against it, and began to cry. It was the first time he had cried since his mother died in 1975. Without even thinking of what he was doing, he cupped his hands under his eyes, and the contact lenses he wore slipped out and lay glistening in his palms. 40 minutes later, feeling husked out and somehow cleansed, he threw his suitcases into the trunk of his MG and backed it out of the garage. The light was fading. He looked at his house with the new plantings. He looked at the beach, at the water, which had taken on the cast of pale emeralds broken by a narrow track of beaten gold. And a conviction stole over him that he would never see any of this again. That he was a dead man walking. "Going home now," Rich Tozier whispered to himself. "Going home, God help me, going home." He put the car in gear and went. Feeling again how easy it had been to slip through an unsuspected fissure in what he had considered a solid life. How easy it was to get over onto the dark side. To sail out of the blue and into the black. Out of the blue and into the black, yes, that was it. Where anything might be waiting. 3. Ben Hanscom takes a drink. If on that night of May 28, 1985, you had wanted to find the man Time magazine had called perhaps the most promising young architect in America, Urban Energy Conservation and the Young Turks, Time, October 15, 1984, you would have had to drive west out of Omaha on Interstate 80 to do it. You'd have taken the Sweet Home exit and then Highway 81 to downtown Sweet Home, of which there isn't much. There you'd turn off on Highway 92 at Bucky's Hi Hat Eat 'em Up. Chicken fried steak our specialty. And once out on the country again, you'd hang a right on Highway 63, which runs straight as a string through the deserted little town of Gatlin, and finally into Hemmingford Home. Downtown Hemmingford Home made downtown Sweet Home look like New York City. The business district consisted of 8 buildings, 5 on one side and 3 on the other. There was the clean-cut barber shop. Propped in the window, a yellowing hand-lettered sign, fully 15 years old, read, "If you're a hippie, get your hair cut somewheres else." The second-run movie house, the Five and Dime, There was a branch of the Nebraska Homeowners Bank, a 76 gas station, a Rexall drug, and the National Farmstead and Hardware Supply, which was the only business in town which looked halfway prosperous. And near the end of the main drag, set off a little way from the other buildings like a pariah and resting on the edge of the big empty, you had your basic roadhouse, the Red Wheel. If you had gotten that far, you would have seen in the potholed dirt parking lot an aging 1968 Cadillac convertible with double CB antennas on the back. The vanity plate on the front read simply, Ben's Caddy. And inside, walking toward the bar, you would have found your man, lanky, sunburned, dressed in a chambray shirt, faded jeans, and a pair of scuffed engineer boots. There were faint squint lines around the corners of his eyes, but nowhere else. He looked perhaps 10 years younger than his actual age, which was 38. "Hello, Mr. Hanscom," Ricky Lee said, putting a paper napkin on the bar as Ben sat down. Ricky Lee sounded a trifle surprised, and he was. He had never seen Hanscom in the wheel on a weeknight before. He came in regularly every Friday night for 2 beers, and every Saturday night for 4 or 5. He always asked after Ricky Lee's 3 boys. He always left the same $5 tip under his beer stein when he took off. In terms of both professional conversation and personal regard, he was far and away Ricky Lee's favorite customer. The $10 a week, and the $50 left under the stein at each Christmas time over the last 5 years, was fine enough. But the man's company was worth far more. Worthwhile company was always a rarity, but in a honky-tonk like this, where talk always came cheap, it was scarcer than hen's teeth. Although Hanscom's roots were in New England and he had gone to college in California, there was more than a touch of the extravagant Texan about him. Ricky Lee counted on Ben Hanscom's Friday-Saturday night stops because he had learned over the years that he could count on them. Mr. Hanscom might be building a skyscraper in New York, where he already had 3 of the most talked-about buildings in the city, a new art gallery in Redondo Beach, or a business building in Salt Lake City. But come Friday night, the door leading to the parking lot would open sometime between 8 o'clock and 9:30, and in he would stroll, as if he lived no farther than the other side of town and had decided to drop in because there was nothing good on TV. He had his own Learjet and a private landing strip on his farm in Junkins. 2 years ago, he had been in London, first designing and then overseeing the construction of the new BBC Communications Center, a building that was still hotly debated pro and con in the British press. The Guardian, perhaps the most beautiful building to be constructed in London over the last 20 years. The Mirror, other than the face of my mother-in-law after a pub crawl, the ugliest thing I have ever seen. When Mr. Hanscom took that job, Ricky Lee had thought, well, I'll see him again sometime, or maybe he'll just forget all about us. And indeed, the Friday night after Ben Hanscom left for England had come and gone with no sign of him, although Ricky Lee found himself looking up quickly every time the door opened between 8 and 9:30. Well, I'll see him again sometime, maybe. Sometime turned out to be the next night. The door had opened at 9:15, and in he had ambled, wearing jeans and a Go Bama t-shirt and his old engineer boots, looking like he'd come from no farther away than cross town. And when Ricky Lee cried almost joyfully, "Hey, Mr. Hanscom, Christ, what are you doing here?" Mr. Hanscom had looked mildly surprised, as if there was nothing in the least unusual about his being here. Nor had that been a one-shot. He had showed up every Saturday during the 2-year course of his active involvement in the BBC job. He left London each Saturday morning at 11 a.m. on the Concorde, he told a fascinated Ricky Lee, and arrived at Kennedy in New York at 10:15 a.m., 45 minutes before he left London, at least by the clock. "God, it's like time travel, ain't it?" an impressed Ricky Lee had said. A limousine was standing by to take him over to Teterboro Airport in New Jersey, a trip which usually took no more than an hour on Saturday morning. He could be in the cockpit of his Lear before noon with no trouble at all, and touching down in Junkins by 2:30. "If you head west fast enough," he told Ricky, "the day just seems to go on forever." He would take a 2-hour nap, spend an hour with his foreman, and half an hour with his secretary. He would eat supper, and then come on over to the Red Wheel for an hour and a half or so. He always came in alone, he always sat at the bar, and he always left the way he had come in, although God knew there were plenty of women in this part of Nebraska who would have been happy to screw the socks off him.
Back at the farm, he would catch 6 hours of sleep, and then the whole process would reverse itself. Ricky had never had a customer who failed to be impressed with this story. "Maybe he's gay," a woman had told him once. Ricky Lee glanced at her briefly, taking in the carefully styled hair, the carefully tailored clothes, which undoubtedly had designer labels, the diamond chips at her ears, the look in her eyes, and knew she was from somewhere back east, probably New York, out here on a brief duty visit to a relative or maybe an old school chum, and couldn't wait to get out again. "No," he had replied. "Mr. Hanscom ain't no sissy." She had taken a pack of Doral cigarettes from her purse and held one between her red, glistening lips until he lit it for her. "How do you know?" she had asked, smiling a little. "I just do," he said. And he did. He thought of saying to her, "I think he's the most god-awful lonely man I ever met in my life." But he wasn't going to say any such thing to this New York woman who was looking at him like he was some new and amusing type of life. Tonight Mr. Hanscom looked a little pale, a little distracted. "Hello, Ricky Lee," he said, sitting down, and then fell to studying his hands. Ricky Lee knew he was slated to spend the next 6 or 8 months in Colorado Springs, overseeing the start of the Mountain States Cultural Center, a sprawling 6-building complex which would be cut into the side of a mountain. "When it's done, people are going to say it looks like a giant kid left his toy blocks all over a flight of stairs," Ben had told Ricky Lee. "Some will, anyway, and they'll be at least half right. But I think it's going to work. It's the biggest thing I've ever tried, and putting it up is going to be scary as hell. But I think it's going to work." Ricky Lee supposed it was possible that Mr. Hanscom had a little touch of stage fright. Nothing surprising about that, and nothing wrong about it either. When you got big enough to be noticed, you got big enough to come gunning for. Or maybe he just had a touch of the bug. There was a hell of a lively one going around. Ricky Lee got a beer stein from the back bar and reached for the Olympia tap. "Don't do that, Ricky Lee." Ricky Lee turned back, surprised. And when Ben Hanscom looked up from his hands, he was suddenly frightened. Because Mr. Hanscom didn't look like he had stage fright or the virus that was going around or anything like that. He looked like he had just taken a terrible blow and was still trying to understand whatever it was that had hit him. "Someone died. He ain't married, but every man's got a family. And someone in his just bit the dust. That's what happened, just as sure as shit rolls downhill from a privy." Someone dropped a quarter in the jukebox, and Barbara Mandrell started to sing about a drunk man and a lonely woman. "You okay, Mr. Hanscom?" Ben Hanscom looked at Ricky Lee out of eyes that suddenly looked 20 years older than the rest of his face, and Ricky Lee was astonished to observe that Mr. Hanscom's hair was graying. He had never noticed any gray in his hair before. Hanscom smiled. The smile was ghastly, horrible. It was like watching a corpse smile. "I don't think I am, Ricky Lee. No, sir, not tonight, not at all." Ricky Lee set the stein down and walked back over to where Hanscom sat. The bar was as empty as a Monday night bar far outside of football season can get. There were fewer than 20 paying customers in the place. Annie was sitting by the door into the kitchen playing cribbage with the short order cook.
"Bad news, Mr. Hanscom?"
"Bad news, that's right. Bad news from home." He looked at Ricky Lee. He looked through Ricky Lee.
"I'm sorry to hear that, Mr. Hanscom."
"Thank you, Ricky Lee." He fell silent, and Ricky Lee was about to ask him if there was anything he could do when Hanscom said, "What's your bar whiskey, Ricky Lee?"
"For everyone else in this dump, it's Four Roses," Ricky Lee said. "But for you, I think it's Wild Turkey."
Hanscom smiled a little at that.
"That's good of you, Ricky Lee. I think you better grab that stein after all. What you do is fill it up with Wild Turkey."
"Fill it?" Ricky Lee asked, frankly astonished. "Christ, I'll have to roll you out of here." Or call an ambulance, he thought.
"Not tonight," Hanscom said. "I don't think so."
Ricky Lee looked carefully into Mr. Hanscom's eyes to see if he could possibly be joking, and it took less than a second to see that he wasn't. So he got the stein from the back bar and the bottle of Wild Turkey from one of the shelves below. The neck of the bottle chattered against the rim of the stein as he began to pour. He watched the whiskey gurgle out, fascinated in spite of himself. Ricky Lee decided it was more than just a touch of the Texan that Mr. Hanscom had in him. This had to be the biggest goddamn shot of whiskey he ever had poured or ever would pour in his life.
Call an ambulance, my ass. He drinks this baby, and I'll be calling Parker and Waters and Sweet Home for their funeral hack.
Nevertheless, he brought it back and set it down in front of Hanscom. Ricky Lee's father had once told him that if a man was in his right mind, you brought him what he paid for, be it piss or poison. Ricky Lee didn't know if that was good advice or bad. But he knew that if you tended bar for a living, it went a fair piece toward saving you from being chomped into gator bait by your own conscience. Hanscom looked at the monster drink thoughtfully for a moment and then asked, "What do I owe you for a shot like that, Ricky Lee?" Ricky Lee shook his head slowly, eyes still on the stein full of whiskey, not wanting to look up and meet those socketed, staring eyes. "No," he said, "this one is on the house." Hanscom smiled again, this time more naturally. "Why, I thank you, Ricky Lee. Now I am going to show you something I learned about in Peru in 1978. I was working with a guy named Frank Billings, understudying with him, I guess you'd say. Frank Billings was the best damned architect in the world, I think. He caught a fever and the doctors injected about a billion different antibiotics into him and not a single one of them touched it. He burned for 2 weeks and then he died. What I'm going to show you I learned from the Indians who worked on the project. The local popskull is pretty potent. You take a slug and you think it's going down pretty mellow, no problem, and then all at once it's like someone lit a blowtorch in your mouth and aimed it down your throat. But the Indians drink it like Coca-Cola, and I rarely saw one drunk, and I never saw one with a hangover. Never had the sack to try it their way myself. But I think I'll give it a go tonight. Bring me some of those lemon wedges there." Ricky Lee brought him four and laid them out neatly on a fresh napkin next to the stein of whiskey. Hanscom picked one of them up, tilted his head back like a man about to administer eye drops to himself, and then began to squeeze raw lemon juice into his right nostril. "Holy Jesus!" Ricky Lee cried, horrified. Hanscom's throat worked, his face flushed, and then Ricky Lee saw tears running down the flat planes of his face toward his ears. Now the spinners were on the juke, singing about the rubber band man. "Oh, Lord, I just don't know how much of this I can stand," the spinners sang. Hanscom groped blindly on the bar, found another slice of lemon, and squeezed the juice into his other nostril. "You're gonna fucking kill yourself," Ricky Lee whispered. Hanscom tossed both of the wrung-out lemon wedges onto the bar. His eyes were fiery red and he was breathing in hitching, wincing gasps. Clear lemon juice dripped from both of his nostrils and trickled down to the corners of his mouth.